From appearing in an infamous movie known for its rumors of death and tragedy to actually committing a crime of murder, the story of Paul Bateson is an intriguing one. What drove him to kill a film industry journalist? And was he involved in more than just one murder that he was convicted of? Today, the story of Paul Bateson on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Paul Bateson is an American convicted murderer and former radiographer. He appeared as a radiological technologist in a scene from the 1973 horror film The Exorcist, which was inspired when the film's director William Friedkin watched him perform a cerebral angiography the previous year. I'm sure I said that wrong. The scene with a considerable amount of blood on screen was for many viewers the film's most disturbing scene. Medical professionals have praised it for its realism. In 1979, Bateson was convicted of the murder of film industry journalist Addison Verrill and sentenced to a minimum of 20 years in prison. In 2003, he was released on parole, which ended after 5 years. Prior to Bateson's trial, police and prosecutors implicated him in a series of unsolved slayings of gay men in Manhattan. Killings he had reportedly boasted about while in jail, bringing it up at his sentencing. However, no additional charges ever were brought against him. The experience inspired Friedkin to make the 1980 film Cruising, which, while based on a novel written decades earlier, incorporated in its storyline the city's leather subculture with which Bateson had identified. In 2012, Friedkin recalled having visited the jailed Bateson prior to his trial and having a conversation which suggested that either Bateson had committed the additional murders or merely that he was considering confessing to them for a lighter sentence. However, there's no other record of incriminating evidence mentioned by Friedkin in that interview. Despite this, Bateson is often inaccurately described as a serial killer. As of 2020, it is not known if Bateson is still alive or if he is where he's living. Friedkin said in a 2018 interview that he had heard Bateson was living somewhere in upstate New York. Social Security record shows that a Paul F. Bateson, with the same birth date and Social Security number issued in Pennsylvania, died on September 15th of 2012. So, today on the dark side of Wikipedia, an individual who is relatively unknown in terms of his acting career, unless you're really big into The Exorcist to know every which thing about it, which there's plenty of people there, and paid attention to the news at the time of that murder. Other than that, you know, probably this one would have gone out into obscurity. But a weird case nonetheless, and I find it kind of interesting because it adds to another layer of the whole Exorcist story. Because there's so many weird things that come out of that movie of people that were involved in things or had dark things happen to them. And it makes you wonder a little bit. But any recollection of Paul Bateson?
That's a hard no.
any wishing you knew more about Paul Bateson a younger child?
Sounds like a stand-up guy would love to have mimicked my life after him. I want to know how, if you kill a person, mm-hmm. you can be up for parole.
That's what I'm interested in, that you actually end up getting released after killing someone. But
whether
it happens.
First degree, second degree, seventh degree, if your charge involves murder as someone not alive anymore, and you were the cause of it, why do you get to be a free person? Whether it's 20 years, 30 years, 90 years, that's just things that make you go, hmm.
Well, a life sentence is defined in different ways. And I'm not obviously an attorney to know the answer to this. But 25 to life is a life sentence is essentially 25 years to life. Meaning, from what I, if I'm getting this correctly, after 25 years, you can be up for parole. But the sentence is life, meaning that they can deny your parole. You can get a life sentence without the possibility of parole, which means it's not a, I mean, that would be a true life sentence. That means there ain't no getting out unless there's some sort of dramatic shift in the evidence of the crime that would require a new trial. But if you have a life sentence, period, and then there is the possibility of parole there, then there is a possibility of you getting out. And that's likely what happened here with the fine Paul Bateson.
I'm curious, what is a cerebral angiography?
I think you probably said it better than I did. I don't know.
Angiography. And let's see here.
I think angiography sounds better. That sounds a little more medical.
Images of blood vessels in and around the brain, thereby allowing detection of abnormalities such as something, something, something. Yeah, this is one of the more intricate intellectual murders that we actually have to find out what the hell he actually did.
Yeah. So we'll jump into the story. And first, let's learn a little bit more about the man and how he became a murderer today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. Sit down, kids, get some crayons, and maybe color how you're feeling as we talk
about
this.
Hold on, popcorn. Oh, it's ready.
Here we go. Bateson was born on August 24th, 1940, and grew up in Lindsdale, Pennsylvania, the son of a... Okay, you got it. This one? I don't know. Metallurgist?
Oh, MacGyver.
I've never seen this title before, but we'll go with it. He would later suggest that this appearance in The Exorcist was revenge on his father for punishing him as a child by making him stay home from Saturday matinees at the local movie theater to listen to opera on the radio instead. He served in the Army in the early 1960s, where he began drinking heavily out of boredom while stationed in Germany, beginning a lifelong struggle with alcoholism. After his discharge, he returned to Lansdale and stopped drinking. In 1964, he moved to New York City, where he began a relationship with a man he would later describe himself as not exclusively gay, who he said was involved in music. The relationship was marked by heavy drinking, either in the form of cocktails at the Pierre and frequent parties at the couple's home, as well as weekends in the Fire Island enclave of Cherry Grove, both with food cooked by Bateson. 5 years later, Bateson's mother died of a stroke, and his younger brother died by suicide. Bateson trained as a neurological radiological technician and began working at that capacity. After the relationship ended in 1973, he moved to the Brooklyn neighborhood of Borough Park. He commuted from there to his job at New York University Medical Center, where he was well-liked and respected by his colleagues. In late 1972, film director William Friedkin visited NYUMC while he was preparing to make The Exorcist, the film adaptation of William Peter Blatty's novel of the same name. He wanted to view some medical procedures since he was considering showing some in the film. He was also looking for staff who might be willing to be extras in the film since he would be shooting interiors in New York, although the film itself is set in Washington, D.C. Dr. Barton Lane invited the director to watch the cerebral thing take place. At the time, such procedures were performed by puncturing the patient's carotid artery in the front of the neck in order to insert the catheter through which of contrast agent was injected in order to make the patient's blood vessels more visible under x-rays. In the moments between the puncture and the intersection of the catheter, blood freely issued from the tube mouth in rhythm with the patient's heartbeat. Friedkin was sufficiently impressed that he told Lane immediately afterward that not only did he want to depict the procedure in the film, he wanted Lane to be the one performing it on camera, along with the nurse, Bateson, the technician who recalled Lane in 2018 was the best he had ever had. A few months later, Friedkin and his crew returned to shoot the scene, blocking off part of the hospital's radiology department for two successive weekends. It was one of the first scenes shot during principal photography, in which the character of Reagan, Linda Blair, is examined medically to see if any of the strange behavior, later found to be the result of demonic possession, she's been exhibiting, can be scientifically explained. Lane later recalled hearing that the crew was still trying to figure out how to make Regan's head spin for a scene later on in the film. That, like the angiogram, became one of the film's best-remembered moments. In the scene, it is Bateson who speaks most of the dialogue, demonstrating the calming bedside manner, another attribute that drew praise from those who worked alongside that he had used with many actual child patients. He can be seen in the background early as Regan is wheeled into the room, helping put her on the table and attaching wires to her shoulder. As the film shows Regan's face in tight close-up, alternating with takes of the procedure being finished, including her blood splurting into the air and staining her surgical gown as it had in the procedure, Fredricken watched. Bateson's voice is heard off camera, instructing her, warning her that the carotid puncture will hurt, and reassuring her as he winces immediately afterward. Upon The Exorcist released at the end of 1973, the scene became notorious as the one that audience found most disturbing, despite its lack of any of the supernatural content that underlies the rest of the film's horror elements. Medical professionals, including Lane and the others involved in the scene, have also praised it as a realistic depiction of the procedure, a special historic interest since it is no longer performed with that carotid puncture, and one of the most realistic depictions of any medical procedure in a popular film. Around the time The Exorcist was released, Bateson's drinking again increased, adversely affecting his social life. "Nobody likes a drunk," he later told The Village Voice. In 1975, it affected his job performance, and NYUMC let him go. Bateson sustained himself with odd jobs, such as doing light repair work and cleaning in apartments near where he now lived in Greenwich Village, and taking tickets at a theater showing pornographic films. He also went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and was successful for a while in staying sober. He socialized with other recovering alcoholic gay men and was hoping to start another long-term relationship. However, by 1977, Bateson had begun drinking more heavily again. He said later that he was drinking at least a quart of vodka a day, which made him passive and curtailed his social life again. "After a few shots, I'd shave and get dressed, intending to go out, but then after the vodka, I had no energy left to move. One of those nights when he was able to get out, Bateson patronized leather bars, something he had started doing back in 1970 with a group that styled themselves as bikers. Leather impresses me," he said later, contrasting it with drag and swish. "They give gays a bad name, like any extreme group would." Then on September 14, 1977, Addison Verrill, a reporter who covered the film industry for Variety, was found dead in his Horato Street apartment. He'd been beaten and stabbed. There were some signs of a struggle. However, nothing of value had been taken. Police believe that if the killer's motive had been robbery, he might have been looking for cash or jewelry, since those could be taken quickly. There was no evidence of forced entry. Verrill had likely let his killer into the apartment. There were several empty beer cans and half-full liquor glasses at the scene. Gay activist journalist Arthur Bell, a friend of Verrill's, wrote an article about the case in The Village Voice, setting it against the larger issue of how murders of gay men, several of which occurred yearly in the village, were rarely taken seriously by police or reported on in the media, since they were seen as results of sexual encounters gone wrong. The police, Bell wrote, had learned that Verrill had been at the Mineshaft, a popular leather bar, until about 6 a.m., talking to many other patrons. According to Bell, Verrill's friends said that while he did not seek the kink that was abundant at the Mineshaft, he nevertheless liked the attitudes of many of the customers. He was considered a regular, holding court at a corner table, not only at the Mineshaft, but the Anvil, another popular leather bar, and other popular gay bars of the era. His presence was seen as making those bars popular. So that's what we know thus far about Paul Bateson and his life and times. Thoughts so far on what we're diving into with this one?
So I think this guy, from a very early age, should have realized, hey, I want to be a phlebotomist. I believe that's what they're called.
Is that the word? Okay.
That work at funeral homes that basically prepare deceased for funerals.
Okay.
With the embalming fluid. And I mean, it sounds as though he definitely had an enjoyment of the medic, just the procedure,
enjoyment,
and talking about
skills,
all that
too.
Touch. So it sounds, as we so often realize, early childhood and such sick and twisted people usually very intelligent, usually have a love and a high drive for something. But this gentleman, rather than doing such harm, man, he could have, if somebody guided him in a little bit different direction, could have done a lot of good opposed to what he did.
Which is the case in so many killers. And I don't want to say serial killers because they believe he wasn't a serial killer, but still a killer nonetheless. Where it's like there's so much potential there. There's a lot of intelligence there. I mean, I don't know why we sometimes think, you know, killers are non-intelligent. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty that are, but those seem to be more, I would say, I don't know, crimes where it's like, you know, you think bar fight and somebody gets beat to death or something. Yeah, that's not necessarily usually going to be, you know, the cream of the crop in terms of intelligence that's involved in that. But where you have these more kind of twisted, these, you know, he's, you know, in the medical field, he's, you know, has a pretty good career life going, aside from his struggles with alcohol. If that could get under control, it's like there's a lot of potential here for this individual in their life. But the biggest thing holding them back is themselves. And then it ends up taking just such a dark turn very quickly when everything is out of control.
I think it's very hard to check yourself when you do have such drive and you are such a when you immerse yourself into something, you don't give 50%, you give 200%. So I think that's a positive in many regards. But if you take a wrong turn and you combine alcohol, drugs, anything negative, it gets bad quite quickly.
Yeah, because if you're going 100% at something and that's how your mode is for everything, you're going to go 100% at that too. Mm-hmm. And that's where it can go dark very, very fast. And then one is just so poisonous, it just ends up, you know, influencing all the other parts of life or overtaking them. So let's continue on with the story of Paul Bateson and learn more about what exactly happened and see how it came to be that he was found guilty of this murder. Bell ended his article by giving the phone number of the New York Police Department's Homicide Bureau and asking anyone with information to call them. Over 8 days after the killing, someone called him claiming to be the killer, apparently to correct Bell's assumption that the killer was a psychopath who targeted gays. "I like your story and like your writing," the caller told him, "but I'm not a psychopath." In a story that ran on the Voices front page, the caller recounted the events of the night that ended in Verrill's murder. "I'm gay, and I needed money, and I'm an alcoholic," he said. After 3 months of sobriety, he claimed he had gone out to the Badlands, a Christopher Street bar, and in the early hours of September 14th, Rivero, whom he did not know, offered to buy him a beer, a proposition the caller accepted. The beer became several, with the two consuming poppers and cocaine in addition to the drinks. At 3 a.m., they left Badlands and went to the mine shaft, where they continued their alcohol and drug consumption. The caller told Bell he was impressed by how popular his companion was. "I didn't realize he was such a superstar. I wanted to go home with him." After 2 hours, he took a taxi to Verrill's apartment, something the caller said Verrill was reluctant to do because he had to get up early and work on a story. The two had more alcohol and cocaine, followed by sex at 7:30 a.m. The caller said that afterwards he realized that he was as far as Verrill had wanted the relationship to go. "I needed money and I hated the rejection. So, still intoxicated, I decided to do something I'd never done before." After incapacitating Verrill with a frying pan from his kitchen, the caller recounted, he stabbed the journalist with a knife, although he said he chose the wrong part of his chest. After the killing, the caller said he took cash totaling $57 and Verrill's master charge card, passport, and some clothes. He used the money to buy liquor and was consequently drunk for the entire next day. Bell confirmed with another source that the man had been seen at a popular bathhouse that night. The caller offered some information about himself besides that relevant understanding the crime. He claimed to be the son of an orchestra leader, to have a wife in Berlin who did not understand his homosexuality, and a teenage son. He had an interest in the arts and had wanted to be a dancer when he was younger. Bell noted that he talked about wanting to atone for the crime several times, which he connected to the conversation taking place on Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. But I don't want to give myself up. I wouldn't be able to practice again. I'd lose my license. He declined to tell Bell what sort of practice the license was for, suggesting that would help identify him. When Bell contacted police about the call, they told him that it seemed like the first solid lead in the case. The caller had known about the stolen credit card, a detail police had not made public, and described a white substance found on the floor of Verrill's apartment as Crisco, a shortening frequently used at the time by gay men as sexual lubricant. Police had not thus far been able to identify it and had also not made the information public. Detectives suspected the caller would call Bell again and went to his apartment to wait with him. At 11 p.m., his phone rang. It was not the original caller, but a man who identified himself as Mitch. He told Bell the killer was Paul Bateson, whom he had gotten to know while the two were drying out at St. Vincent's Hospital a few months earlier. While he believed Bateson was not the man's real name, since he knew the man to have used a pseudonym Johnny Johnson at one point, he said Bateson was an unemployed X-ray technician and that he had called him earlier and confessed to the crime. Mitch asked to meet Bell in person, but the police told Bell not to do so. Instead, they just arrested Bateson at his East 12th Street apartment, where he was lying around drunk. When he was asked if he knew why he was being arrested, he pointed to an open copy of The Voice with Bell's article and indicated that was probably why. A detective went to the bar and brought Mitch in for questioning as well. He was released after a few hours. Bateson eventually gave police a handwritten confession that was consistent with what he had told Bell. Bateson was charged with second-degree murder and detained while awaiting trial. Bell interviewed Bateson in person a month later, visiting him at Rikers Island. Bateson talked generally about his life, something he said he did often, as did other acquaintances of Bateson whom Bell spoke with. Jail, he said, was helping him to again get sober. His biggest regret about being in custody was missing the new season of the Joffe Ballet at the time, based in New York. Bell admitted that he too might have taken Bateson up on an offer to go to his apartment if he had met him at a bar rather than at a jail. While Bateson avoided talking about the crime he was charged with and what Bell supposed to be advice from his attorney, he did talk about the trial. He had pleaded not guilty and expected that to be the verdict after a long trial. A lot of people will be hurt, parents, friends, then I'll tear up my roots and settle somewhere else. Suspicion in serial killings. At the time of Bateson's arrest, police had also been investigating a series of murders of gay men over the previous 2 years, which they believe were committed by the same person due to similarities in the killings' modus operandi. Six corpses of men had been found dismembered in bags floating in the Hudson River. None of them have ever been identified, but police traced the clothes on the men to shops in Greenwich Village that catered to the gay community. Since the bags reportedly had wording on them, connecting them to NYUMC's neuropsychiatric unit, and the dismemberment of the bodies appeared to have been done by someone skilled at using a knife. Investigators began to suggest publicly that Bateson might be a suspect in, as they referred to officially, the CUPPI killings for circumstances unknown pending police investigation as well. Those killings were the subject of another interview Bateson gave, although it would not be made public until 2012. Fedrickin, who recalled him from both his initial visit to NYUMC and the filming of the angiography for The Exorcist as a nice young man who stood out due to the earring and studded bracelet he wore, neither of which were common accessories for men at the time, wrote a long story about the case in the Daily News. Surprised that the gentle Bateson, he recalled, could have been ever accused of being a murderer, Fedrickin came to Rikers to talk with him after getting permission from Bateson's lawyer. In an interview with Movies The Notebook that coincided with the release of his film Killer Joe, Fedrickin stated Bateson admitted killing Verrill, although the director then incorrectly stated that Bateson had dismembered the body and thrown the bagged body parts in the river. Bateson said that the prosecutors were offering him a deal whereby if he confessed to the bag murders and some other unsolved killings, he would receive a shortened sentence. He told Fredkin he was not sure if he would accept it. In a 2018 episode of the Hollywood Reporter's It Happened in Hollywood podcast, Fredkin attributed to Bateson a confession to the unsolved murders. As a result of his conversation with Bateson, Fredkin decided it was time to make the film adaptation of New York Times reporter Gerald Walker's 1970 novel, Cruising, about a police officer going undercover in the gay community to catch a serial killer. Life had already imitated art, with an NYPD officer, Randy Jurgensen, going undercover in gay bars since he was similar in appearance to the victims of the bag killer. Intrigued by the leather subculture Bateson had told him about, Fredkin knew Matthew Leonello, the mafioso who owned the mineshaft and other Manhattan gay bars of the era, and was able to visit the bar himself. He later added scenes set there to his film, released in 1980, to mixed reviews after heavy protests by the city's gay community during production. In pretrial motion, Bateson, through his attorney, attempted to have his confession suppressed. He argued that he had been drunk at the time and the police had not yet read him his rights. Bateson also denied having made the phone calls to Bell, claiming his purported confession was just based on what he had read about the case in The Voice. Bateson went on trial in early 1979. The state entered both his confession and Bell's Voice article into evidence against him. Contrary to his prediction of a long trial in the wake of his arrest, Bateson was convicted after 4 days on March 5, 1979. At Bateson's sentencing, a month later, prosecutor William Hoyt called him a psychopath and reiterated his belief that he was responsible for the 6 unsolved murders. While Hoyt admitted there was no direct proof of this, he said that Bateson had confessed to those crimes in a conversation with Richard Ryan, a friend who had testified for the state at the trial, that Bateson had confessed to Verrill's murder to him. Speaking for himself, Bateson denied any role in the other murders. Justice Morris Goldman sentenced Bateson to 20 years to life in prison, 5 years less than the minimum Hoyt had asked for. He ultimately found the connection to the other murders too ethereal to merit any consideration in sentencing Bateson. In a 2018 Esquire article about Bateson, writer Matt Miller was unable to find what that evidence might have been, as the New York County Clerk's office could not find a copy of the trial transcript. Nothing Miller had been able to review mentioned either the bags purportedly being traced to NYUMC or any mention of a deal offered to Bateson if he confessed to the other murders. Prison terms and release, Bateson ultimately served 24 years and 3 months of his sentence, becoming eligible for parole in 1997. On the day of his 63rd birthday in August 2003, he was released from Arthur Kill Correctional Facility on Staten Island. According to online records kept by the state's Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, his parole was successfully completed in November of 2008. That was the last public record of Bateson available as of 2020. Where he is living, or even if he is alive, is not known. Miller attempted to contact Bateson for his Esquire article in 2018 and his last known address to the Long Island village of Freeport, but was unsuccessful as the phone had been disconnected. Emails to different addresses either bounced or were not answered. In his podcast interview around the same time, Fredrickson said he had heard Bateson was living somewhere in upstate New York. A record in the Social Security Death Index shows that a Paul F. Bateson with the same birth date and a Social Security number issued in Pennsylvania died on September 15th of 2012. So I don't know that that exactly answers how you end up getting out of prison for murdering someone 25 years later. But I guess you can murder someone and get out of prison 25 years later.
So if you're bored right now, and let's see here, 2046, you know.
2046 sounds okay to you, then I guess, well, I don't know. I don't know what that, how that works. Because it was second degree murder. Second degree is what? What does that one mean?
It's like a B plus on a test, like almost an A. He could have done a little bit better job of filleting the body.
That's not what it means. It's nothing to do with filleting. It's all about sauteing. Everybody knows that. Generally defined as intentional murder that lacks premeditation. Okay, so it's intended to cause bodily harm, demonstrates extreme indifference to human life, but it basically ends up in death. So not quite intentional, but you still ended up killing somebody because you went too far. So first degree is intentional. First degree is like premeditated, right?
Yes. A couple years ago, it was definitely first degree that I'd had.
Yeah. Intentional murder, willful, premeditated, malice aforethought. So that's where it's like, okay. So I guess second degree, you kind of get the chance to get off early. Third degree is what? Non-intentional? Is that like a traffic accident?
Or is that manslaughter? Because manslaughter, I think, or vehicular, now we're getting into many different scenarios. Murder is if you are in an accident and there is a fatality, I think that would be classified as manslaughter, where you literally had no control over what happened, but somebody died and you were the cause of it.
Yeah. Third degree murder is a category of murder defined by the laws of three states in the U.S., Florida, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania, also formally defined in Mexico and Wisconsin.
There was no plan or event and intent to harm.
Yeah.
Examples being that voluntary manslaughter arises if the defendant is suddenly provoked and while in the midst of anger causes enough harm to someone that they die. Involuntary manslaughter generally means that the defendant was reckless in their actions and the result caused someone to die.
So there you go. So it was truly a second degree murder. It doesn't sound like he went out there trying to find someone to kill. It's just almost like he snapped or something and then, you know, did it. And so still, if you did it and there was intent at the time, to me, that still is like, I'm sorry, you don't get to get out in 25 years.
So do you believe someone can snap in a fit of rage and do something that they maybe later will apologize for? I'm not talking about killing people, but an argument. Do you believe it is valid if under stress that person then is warranted the opportunity to apologize and
sure,
give a little bit of validity to why they lost their cool?
Yeah. Yeah.
You lose that if it involves in killing someone.
If you kill someone, if that ends up involving killing someone, that's different because there's a lot more. And then you have to take into account, you know, were they provoked? Were they, you know, how did it happen? All of those things need to be taken into consideration.
If they were unknowingly drugged, or they were unknowingly put in some situation, then they did something.
Did they feel threatened? Did they feel, you know, if someone's, you know, sitting there, you know, kidnapping someone or not letting them leave, and, you know, maybe it's a joke, but the other person's not taking it as a joke and they end up killing the person and getting out of there, you know, I don't know. There's just so many, you have to take it situation by situation. But in a case like this, it's like, no, you fucking killed them. And it seemed to be that you know, maybe not super premeditated, but you killed somebody, you stabbed them, you went and got the knife and you did it. It wasn't like you tipped a big vase over on his head on accident, you know, or something like that, you know, or some weird sexual kink or something where the like asphyxiation or something and oops, you know, that went too far. He took a knife willingly and stabbed him. And that to me is very different than any sort of self-defense or things of that nature. Now, could you snap? Sure. But you snap.
What it doesn't say in this here, was it good behavior? Was the prison overcrowded? So there's no talk of that. And I have no idea if that was just the sentence was what the sentence was. He was up for parole and he was granted parole. But there may have been some extenuating circumstances where that played into it. I shouldn't say all too often, but sometimes people who have murdered someone, you hear that they get released due to good behavior.
Yeah.
Wait a minute here. Good behavior. You killed someone in 1996. I don't care if you were a model citizen for 22 years in jail. You killed someone.
Yeah.
But that may have played into it.
And that's why we have all the different degrees of murder and why there's, you know, all the arguments that are made. And it's not decided by two people hosting a podcast. But it's,
thank goodness.
But that's where, you know, we end up looking at some of these cases and you go, Well, the system seems kind of broken, you know, just with what people will be charged with or not charged with. And it can work both ways, too, where it's like, why were they not charged with this? Or why were they charged with something so extreme for a crime that wasn't, that didn't fit the bill? There's a lot of brokenness to the system, but it's the system that we got. So it's, how do we deal with it is the question. But yeah, I mean, I am surprised that he did get out at all, but it from what it sounds like, he did what, if you were to, you know, the reality is, okay, he can get out. He did get out. What would ideally the best life for that person be, so they don't harm people? A life of seclusion far away and no one knows that he exists. And that's pretty much what he did. So I got to give him credit for that and say, you know what? He went off to seclusion and just kind of did his own thing and wasn't a harm to others, which is good. Unfortunately, so many people who are murderers and have the capability to do such a thing do it again. And that's where, I mean, it's like child molesters and shit. I think it's like, it's either in you or it's not in you. It's not, there's no gray area where like, well, it just hit me today and I just felt like I should go do that. It's like, no, either that's something you are capable of doing or you're not capable of doing.
And, really, officer, yeah. I just woke up one day and had 12 years of child pornography on my laptop. Yeah. And that's when I just happened to go to the elementary school with my pants off and kill 7 children.
I mean, it's shown. I mean, it's like you can't really recover from that. That's either part of your makeup or it's not. Now, as far as you, the belief on how to rehabilitate or really you can't rehabilitate these people is really how I feel based on the science. I mean, you literally have communities out there. There's an area, I forget where it is, but it's like called Pedophile Village or something. And the whole town is like all fucking pedophiles. And because they're all just live amongst each other and they're not, kids aren't supposed to be there. And a lot of them try to just stay to themselves because they know that they have this thing. But again, it's one of those things where if you're a murderer, if you're capable of murdering someone with intent, whether it's premeditated or not, if you're capable of molesting a child, premeditated or not, my belief would be that's in you. You're able to do it. If you're able to do it once, you're very likely able to do it again, and the potential exists. Whether or not you will again, I don't know. But the fact that threat exists to the general public and you're out there, I don't think you should be in the general public, period. And that's just kind of how I feel about things like that. It's like, if you're going to be a threat to innocent human beings because of what is the, you hold that ability, you shouldn't be back out there. I suppose that anyone could argue anyone could do some of those things. No, I don't really think anyone could. I think people could kill anyone. I think could kill in self-defense, but I don't think anyone could just kind of kill at a second degree level. I think that's where it gets more dicey.
For those of you tuning in that, wanted that address again, 3 miles east of Pahokee, Florida. In 2014, the name was officially changed to City of Refuge, but it's still generally referred to as Miracle Village. The site was chosen because of its isolation, given that the sex offender residence restrictions do not apply.
Jesus.
The village you were referencing, that is composed of 54 duplexes, 6 family homes, operated by Matthew 25 Ministries.
I think I saw Louis Theroux did a documentary on it, or somebody did a documentary on it. It was kind of interesting. It was interesting and disturbing as shit all at the same time.
Community is so popular with sex offenders, there's not enough room for them.
Oh my God.
So they settled in a nearby town, Pahokee, with the help of a religious ministry.
Well, what's the lesser of the evils? Would you rather have them all in a village that's self-contained to themselves? Or would you rather have to be checking the registry and make sure that one didn't move down the road from you?
In 2020, we learned the term bubble more than ever.
Yeah.
I'm okay with the SOB just outside of Pahokee Village, Florida.
Yeah.
Sex offender bubble. And then we slowly, you know, turn the oxygen off.
What? Literally make it into a bubble and slowly turn the oxygen off. Yeah, since my Tony Land doesn't exist and we can't just eliminate the sex offenders from the planet, I guess the best option I think might be something like that. I would just hope that it's policed in some way, shape, or form very well, that there's no children coming to visit Sex Offender Island, and they're not getting out, you know, to go visit the local defunct Toys R Us that children are crying in front of because the doors are closed, going, "Hey, look what I have in my van." You know, it's just all these little wonders of life that you learn about as an adult and you go, "Really, this shit exists?"
And on Main Street in SOB, come on by for the grand reopen Toys R Us, Kmart, Pila Shoes, and Blockbuster Gaming section.
You find out the only place Blockbuster, Toys R Us,
and John Johnson Auto Sales, where we exclusively sell white vans with no windows.
And there happens to be a Showbiz pizza that's still there. It never turned to a Chuck E. Cheese. It's still a Showbiz.
Why does this department store have no pants section? Because you're never going to fucking buy pants.
Jesus Christ. It could be a fucked up town. So see, there's 50 ways that town could go wrong right there. So I don't know.
Someone will become a millionaire out of it.
If someone told you when you were like 13, all of the ways that this world works, or just some of these more shocking things that we learn about as adults and go, really, there's a fucking town like this?
I would move across the world. I would move to the United Kingdom.
I don't know what the fuck I would do. I think my mind would just be, I mean, it's blown when I hear about these things now, but it's like at a younger age to hear some of these things, like, really, there's people like this that exists, like Sex Offender Village. Holy shit. But I don't know. I don't know if the shock point of what, you know, what would have been shocking to us at 13, you know, in the mid 90s, very different than what shocks a 13-year-old in 2020, you know.
Very different. I think the shock and awe value, I think we as a society peaked about, 5 years ago. And I think our brain, unbeknownst to us, has now allowed such a high level of WTF-ness that what shocked us in 2000. And I really don't think it matters if you were 9 years old or 29 years old. I just think that there's a certain level of, I mean, you go back to World War II, you go back to, I mean, the Civil War. I mean, you go back to if your a husband or your wife would go and fight for the country, die this side or the other, that is a travesty. And there is a pain, immense feelings. Fast forward to current day. Things that would, I believe, be so much bigger of a deal and take a higher emotional toll on us, doesn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't. Which is very sad. There's really no positive or moral of the story, or something on Reading Rainbow that Mr. Burton would talk about in a good way. But I think it's pretty sad, but we just kind of have to roll with it and we move on.
And on that, I think we will we'll wrap things up for today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like the show, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you would download podcasts. Press subscribe. We greatly appreciate that. Let your friends know that we exist. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.